Yes, and policy to order. Representative Hornstein, Chair Hornstein, and Vice Chair Cagle both have bills up in other committees right away, so they asked me to step in this afternoon. So I'll call this meeting March 29th, 2022, to order. And this meeting is being held virtually for House Rule 10.01. Mr. Dodge, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
I'm present.
Nelson, present. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr?
Here.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, present.
Elkins, present. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Hausman?
Present.
Hausman, present. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosnick?
Present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Mason?
Mason, present.
Mason, present. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, present.
Murphy, present. Representative Olson?
Olson, present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson?
Present.
Richardson, present. Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson, present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West?
Present.
West, present. There is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge. We have a quorum. And Mr. Howe, did the viewer named Apple, did they ever identify themselves? They're on now.
I think, see the gentleman there. It may be Representative Bowe, maybe one of the testifiers for today's bill.
I do have three, so there it could be one of those three.
Okay, perhaps Mr. Webster or Mr. McGuire.
Mark Webster. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now. Just trying to make sure your microphone, everything works. We were trying to do that earlier, but anyway. Next, after the roll call, the next item on the agenda is the minutes, and Representative Petersburg, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did, and I would like to move the minutes of the March 24th meeting.
Representative Petersburg moves the minutes from the March 25th meeting. Everybody want to unmute, and all in favor of the minutes, approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Our minutes have been approved. Again, members, I was asked to chair this while Representative Hornstein presents his bill. Representative Cagle has a bill up also. When they get back, we'll hand it back over to them. The first bill we have on our agenda today is Representative Bowe, House File 2236. You can't talk after eating lunch today. Representative Bowe, I'll move the bill to have it in front of us. The intention is to lay this over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Bowe, if you want to explain your bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate this opportunity for a quick hearing on House File 2236. You know, it really comes down to this. On June 7th, 1958, Prince Rogers Nelson was born right here in Minnesota. And Prince became famous worldwide and had phenomenal success in the music industry. But yet, despite all that success and all that fame, he chose to stay right here in Minnesota. And that's really a big part of what is driving this effort to recognize and to honor Prince by designating a segment of State Highway 5 within the borders of Chanhassen as Prince Rogers Nelson Memorial Highway. And so, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, I would like to have this held over for possible inclusion. I do have an A1 amendment that will just get the bill in the proper condition for us.
And I see that here on the agenda that you have. If you want to move, I'll move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wants. Again, members, if you want to unmute, any questions, or if you briefly explain what the amendment does, Representative Bowe.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just cleaning up the language around the hope that we have that the signage put on both ends of this segment of designated highway will be purple in color. And that's kind of a challenging one with MnDOT. So we're hoping it can be purple in color, and we're hoping perhaps the symbol that Prince has used on a lot of his albums could be on that sign as well. But we wanted to make it something that, you know, the legislative intent is clear that we hope for that, but yet we, it originally in the bill, I think it said must. So we wanted to just get the verbiage in the proper shape.
Thank you, Representative Bull. So members, if you want to unmute, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Mason, you put your hand up, or was that?
Just wanted to ask what the problem was with the purple.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mason. I am told that MnDOT says these signs have always been brown in the past. So they haven't said no to purple, but they've just said they've always been brown in the past. We're hopeful that we can nudge this one over to purple just because that was such an important color for Prince.
Representative Bull, we'll get to your testifiers. I've got three listed here. We'll start with Mr. Webster. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak for this. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of this project that we're spearheading. Prince, I'm from South Minneapolis. Prince has been a longtime friend of myself. And when Prince's passing went past, I took it upon myself to try to give something back to Prince. Prince has given a lot to us in this city, a Chanhassen, in the state of Minnesota. And I was coming to work one day, and I work at Paisley Park, and I said, well, what if we rename this highway Prince Rogers Nelson? And when I thought of that, a friend of mine that you'll be hearing, Bob Bowe, I asked him what he helped me with, and he said he would. At that time, I went all the way down that highway asking people, businesses and everything, what would you think of this place, this highway being highway, Prince Rogers Nelson Highway? And people were just appalled, and this was delighted to see that change happen. A little bit more, Prince has given so much to Chanhassen, has given so much to the state of Minnesota and the world, and I would think something like this would enlighten Chanhassen, would enlighten the world in itself, to be recognized. We know Prince never asked for anything. He's given a lot to people, and I'm just looking forward to hopefully that this bill will pass, that we can name part of Highway 5, Prince Rogers Nelson Memorial Highway.
And, sir, if you want to state your name for the record.
Mark Webster.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. The next person we have on our list is Bob Finn. And, again, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Everybody can hear me okay?
Great.
All right. Yes. Good. Again, my name is Bob Finn. Greg mentioned that Bob Bow, but I'm Bob Finn.
Sorry.
I confused myself with Greg. But anyway, thanks again for the opportunity to testify at this hearing. I'm a 28-year resident of Chanhassen and nearby neighbor to Paisley Park. And so over the years, I've seen firsthand of his generosity, Prince's generosity. You know, not only was he our local music icon, he was a, you know, very generous philanthropist who quietly and frequently donated millions to not only schools and organizations in our own community, but also nationally and globally as well. You know, special interest to him was disadvantaged youth. There are numerous comments on both our, we have two websites that we've started in order to hopefully get this bill passed and the Memorial Highway designated for Prince. You know, there's numerous comments on both of our petition website and our GoFundMe websites that pertain to what an honor it would be to drive down this Memorial Highway and to visit Paisley Park and also support the local businesses and restaurants and so forth that he also supported. So, you know, with that, we've also, you know, with our GoFundMe, we've raised the sufficient funding for the signage required for this project, so there would be no taxpayer expense whatsoever. And, you know, we've also had some discussion with MDOT as well, you know, just leading up to this. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify at this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Finn. The next person I have on the list is Mitch McGuire. Again, if you want to identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Mitch McGuire. I am the managing director at Paisley Park. I just wanted to say briefly thank you to Representative Bowe, the members of the committee, for allowing Paisley an opportunity to say some words in support of the bill. And, you know, I will just echo what I think you've already heard from the other folks who've talked about this already. But, you know, for 35 years, this building has been a part of our cultural heritage here in this community. And for nearly 30 of those years, what Prince did within the four walls of this building is what allowed him to really become the global icon that he would certainly grow into. And I think, you know, though Prince did live other places over time, certainly Paisley Park was always home base for him. And that was largely due to, I think, the relationship he was able to develop with the folks in this community. They obviously knew who he was, and as a result, I think afforded him the respect, the privacy that he deserved. And as a result, was able to lead likely what was the most normal lifestyle someone of Prince's ilk could lead here in this community. And as a result, I think he opened up his doors to perfect strangers to come into this home and, you know, was very generous in that way, would play these epic late night Paisley Park concerts and all the stories that we've heard about people leaving as the sun was coming up and having been served pancakes on their way out the door. But as Mr. Finn mentioned, you know, there was more to Prince than just that. There was obviously a philanthropic arm to everything he did. And that, those are the kinds of things that we tended to learn about in greater detail after Prince passed. But one of the things we communicate to our folks who come through to Paisley Park now is that though Prince's, you know, his was a loss that came entirely too soon, we were really lucky to have had him for as long as we did. And all of these things that he left behind for us, his music, his art, this building, those are the things that we'll continue to enjoy for the rest of our lives and be able to share with others who now come after us. So this idea that we can rename this street, which leads to this building that we know was so important to him and which was home to all of this creative output, I think to me makes perfect sense and is a perfect homage to an individual who gave so much, not only to us, but to people around the world. So thank you again. And just know that Paisley Park has the full support of this bill and the Prince Estate. We're happy to do whatever we can to move this forward.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Questions, members? Questions on the bill? Questions of any of the testifiers? Seeing no hands jumping up and or people waving at their cameras, I'll renew my motion that House File 2236 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Bowe, and thank you, testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you very much.
The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 3456, Representative Kosnick. And again, the intent is to lay this over. And Representative Kosnick, do I need to make the motion, Mr. Howard?
No, you can proceed with explaining the bill.
Okay, Representative Kosnick, do you want to explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is, I have to laugh a little bit because Chair Nelson and I are on the State Government Finance Committee, so we had a committee meeting this morning, so that's why I made the joke earlier, make sure I was in the right committee.
But deja vu. Deja vu all over again, yes. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Planes, trains, and automobiles. As committee members, we realize in order to move product and people to market in an efficient manner, a multimodal approach works best. House File 3456 is a bill that enhances our overall transportation system by assisting our rail use to improve the efficiency of freight rail through the state. This bill will assist in the planning and engineering of a freight rail car storage facility in the Air Lake Industrial Park in the southern end of Lakeville, and it is a one-time appropriation. And the Air Lake Industrial Park is home to almost 150 businesses, making it the second largest industrial park in the state. The industrial park offers businesses ease of access to Interstate I-35, close proximity to the Air Lake Airport. Industrial zone parcels have nearby commercial and office park parcels, and many sites are available on rail lines, and outdoor storage is available in some sites as well. The Air Lake Industrial Park is also home to Progressive Rail, which is a short line rail service company that operates in many areas of the state and many of our members' areas. With us today is Lakeville City Administrator Justin Miller, who will discuss both the environmental and the safety and community concerns, but in addition, the economic opportunity that an efficient rail yard would provide. I'd like to share with members in closing that while this project is located in Lakeville, the work done here is a link and a connection to the many communities and industries across the state. Rail is really another mode of connecting commerce across the state, much like the Corridors of Commerce program that we discussed last week. The storage of rail cars across Lakeville and through the middle of our town has become an issue for a variety of reasons that Mr. Miller will discuss. But it's connected to work being done or to be done at other rail terminals in the cities of Minneapolis, Bloomington, Eagan, Rosemont, to the south, Cannon Falls, Randolph, Northfield, and Faribault. In addition to Progressive Rail has terminals across the state, across the country, but including Northern Iowa in Mason City to Clear Lake. So while this is headquartered in the district I represent, this really is an opportunity to enhance a rail facility in a more efficient manner across the state, benefiting many different industries that they currently service in many of your communities. So thank you for the consideration of this project. And again, Mr. Miller is available here to both testify, Mr. Chair, and also we would be willing to take any committee questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Miller. If you want to state your name for the record, and I believe you got slides you're going to run, but Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Miller. I'm the Lakeville City Administrator. Thanks for having me today. I am going to share my screen. So we are very appreciative of the committee hearing this bill and for Representative Kosnick for introducing it. Let me make sure I can advance my slides here. There we go. The challenge, in a nutshell, is that there are obsolete, or the technical term, legal term is exempt, Canadian Pacific Rail lines within Lakeville. They're currently leased by Progressive Rail, which Representative Kosnick outlined. The challenges that I'm going to briefly talk about are public safety, negative neighborhood impacts, impacts on school children, potential watershed issues, as well as this is an outdated line that is only used right now for storage of rail cars. It is not used for actual rail transport. So imagine if you lived in a neighborhood and you woke up every day and this was outside your back door or outside your window. Or imagine if you were driving down County Road 50 in Lakeville, one of the most heavily traveled roads in the city, and these cars were lining up and down the highway. This is what we deal with on a fairly routine basis in Lakeville. And this is what one of the challenges that we're trying to solve with this project. Here are just some more images. The image on the right is at 196 and Jaguar Avenue. There is one way in and one way out of this neighborhood. And a lot of times, many times, when they are moving these cars, it blocks the access to this neighborhood, not only for residents, but for police, fire, ambulance. It creates a significant public safety access issue for our first responders. Imagine if you're on the left, and this is what you wake up to every day, and you can see the property value diminished. This property actually had to sell their property because this is what they were looking at every day. And you can imagine what the property value did for that. There's obviously public safety issues. This is an attractive nuisance. We don't advocate or condone kids climbing on rail cars. That is not a good issue. They are trespassing, they're breaking the law. We enforce it as much as we can, but kids are going to be kids. And then, as everybody knows, these are a canvas for graffiti artists. We see those throughout everywhere that we see rail cars. And while Progressive Rail and Canadian Pacific do their best, it is just impossible to keep up with. And these are unsightly throughout the city. Just a few more pictures that these are taken by residents. You know, this is just not acceptable. It's not something that we want. It's not something Progressive Rail wants. And hopefully if we get them off of this in the neighborhoods, these kids won't see these as an attractive nuisance and a place to congregate. So just as some context, the map on the right is a section of Lakeville. The circle on the bottom right is right next to Air Lake Airport and is in the industrial park. This is Progressive Rail's headquarters. For 3.3 miles to the line or to the circle on the top is where the vast majority of the storage occurs. But if you zoom in into the project or to the map on the left, that is the most problematic area. You'll see that this line goes right through neighborhoods, right in the backyards of some houses. Those are the pictures that I showed you earlier. And then on the very top left, where that circle is, it actually goes across Lake Marion. And these cars, while they are stored and are empty, we do know that it's possible that they could have some residue of anything that travels in rail cars. And we're very thankful and hopeful that nothing ever happens, but it is a possibility that it could impact the watershed there at Lake Marion. So with any challenge, we like to see the opportunity. And this is the opportunity that we see. As Representative Kosnick mentioned, this is a great opportunity for us to vastly increase the interstate commerce capabilities of our industrial park through rail improvements and freight access. Obviously, it would remove the blight from the local neighborhoods, but it would produce a safe and modern rail storage and transload yard for Progressive Rail. And it would increase significantly the operational efficiencies and economic development opportunities in our industrial park. Like Representative Kosnick said, there are well over 150 businesses in our industrial park. Small businesses up to some of the more well-known names like Boise Cascade, Uponor, Amazon, and FedEx Freight all have locations in the industrial park and all would have access and be benefited by more access to rail capacity. The proposed project is shown here. I know this is a little bit hard to see, but on the bottom right is Air Lake Airport. Air Lake Airport is a reliever airport owned by the Metropolitan Airports Commission. They own the land just to the northwest of this as well. That land cannot be built on because of safety regulations and FAA regulations, but they can have rail storage located on here. So what we would like to do is the red diamond on the right-hand side is where Progressive Rail's headquarters are. If they have a spur line, that's where a lot of their traffic starts and ends. We would like to then build a series of rail right next to them, a spur line off of their main line. Those are those green lines. This would become a storage area that would accommodate enough storage that would take all the cars that are currently parked within Lakeville and move them out of the neighborhoods and into a more suitable area, which would be our industrial park. Not only would it be a storage area, but the potential design could have space to where semis or other vehicles could come in and load or unload cars right off of that spur line. This would obviously increase the economic development capabilities of Progressive Rail and the industrial park in general. So the project status, we do have support from our congressional delegation. We are working closely with our federal delegation on the many different programs that are available in Washington, D.C. We do have an agreement between the city and Progressive Rail. We are sharing the cost right now of a preliminary study that's going to do some survey work to get to the next step on this project. And we expect those results to be done here yet this spring. And we have lots of partners in this, obviously the city, the county, and our state legislators. I mentioned the local school district because our school buses, there's a school close to this line as well. They often get delayed when cars are going back and forth and moving at the crossing that I mentioned. They would be very happy not to have those delays. The businesses in the industrial park, like I mentioned, are both small and national, would be very supportive. We do have support from the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Progressive Rail and Canadian Pacific, but most importantly, the citizens of Lakeville and the community leaders, especially those who drive by this or who live by this every day, are very supportive. So with that, that is my presentation, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Questions, members? questions? I see Representative Chair Hornstein's back, so we'll give it back.
Mr. Chair, I'm back very temporarily because I have another bill coming up.
And I will continue. I was going to say after the bill, we'll give you the chair back. But no, Representative Murphy, you got your hand up.
Yes, I do have my hand up because I'm concerned. How did this blight start? Did this start with Progressive Rail, or did this happen before Progressive Rail? And did the city zoning laws allow this blight to occur?
Representative Kosnick, can you answer that, or should Mr. Miller?
Oh, I'd be happy to address that. Thank you, Representative Murphy. I've lived in Lakeville for over 20 years, and this segment of line is exempt and obsolete in many cases, north of where they're storing the cars and where the cars drive over. The tracks are in pretty bad shape, but they have a lease agreement with the rail line. And so empty storage cars during the last recession to keep things, the economy moving for Progressive, decided to take extra cars from across the country and store them across town. That wasn't something that normally happened. Mr. Miller can talk about the city zoning ordinances. But so this has been going on for a while, and it was not always that way. So when people built homes and developed neighborhoods, there wasn't existing ongoing freight going through there. But the tracks were there. But they've been exempt for at least 20 years, probably twice as long as that, I might guess. Mr. Miller can talk about the city zoning efforts because that's an important question. Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, federal preemption really hamstrings cities on what we can do in terms of any enforcement on rail lines. We've tried every legal outlet that we can think of. We've actually issued citations before, and they've been thrown out in court. So whether it's, if there was graffiti on a house or on a wall or something like that, we could enforce that. When it's on the a rail line, we are rarely hamstrung by federal preemption on anything that happens on a rail line.
Representative Murphy.
So then, as I understand it then, didn't used to have this problem, but now we do because we have a new operating rail line that brought in cars from other places.
Mr. Miller.
And now they want to be rewarded for that by the state taking over the appropriations for cleaning it up and putting these in, I don't know if you're putting them in little garages or what. I'm not clear on that. But you're going to still have rail cars stored there, but in a more unsightly or a more sightly approved area. That's what I gather from what this appropriation would be for.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. The issue, like Representative Kosnick mentioned, it really started in earnest during the last recession. And that is when a lot of these cars actually started, their frac sand cars were kind of, if I remember right, the very first cars that they started to store. When there was not the demand for frac sand, there was a place need to store a lot of these cars. And so Progressive Rail leases these lines and is looking for a business opportunity, and we don't begrudge them for that. That's certainly their right. What we are trying to do is to find a location that's more suitable in the industrial park from not just a neighborhood perspective and a safety perspective, but also from an economic development perspective, because they will not only be able to store cars here, it'll allow them to more efficiently transfer materials to the businesses that are in the industrial park, or that can get on then on semi trucks and transfer out to anywhere else in the state and the country through the local transportation network that we're connected to.
And Mr. Miller, would it be, could you, would it be fair to say that having them all in one place instead of stretched out over many miles, that it would be easier to keep track of these and to protect them from the public climbing on them, whatever happens, Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, I think that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Representative then, Murphy.
So is there, in the industrial park then, will there be rail line service to there, to the industrial park?
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, there already is rail service to industrial park. This would just be extending that and expanding it.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Then will this area that has these cars parked on now, then that will be open for different kind of development or for tree planting or whatever to make it more pleasant for the people that are living around it? Is that correct?
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, that would certainly be the city's long-term goal. We would put in with the so this gets into the weeds a little bit about how this will work, but the city will be leasing the land from the MAC to build this this storage yard, and then we would sublease that to Progressive Rail. So the intent is to hold local taxpayers harmless on that, but part of that sublease agreement would be conditioned upon Progressive Rail no longer storing these cars in the residential neighborhoods. And so then, once we got that done, we would engage with Progressive Rail and the underlying owner, Canadian Pacific, about possible future use of this rail corridor.
Hmm. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Constance. I think we can probably talk about something in the future.
Representative Koznick, did you want to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Murphy, I did want to just kind of clarify, too, that this appropriation is for to help with the planning and development of a rail yard to enhance economic development. It is not the actual building of the rail yard that it would down the road be have more cost participation with the companies involved in the city, but also the city and Progressive Rail have undertaken a kind of a preliminary engineering study that they will be completing in a couple month or two or so this spring. So just to be clear, this isn't actually building the rail facility yet. That'll be at another later date, but by having this planning and development underway and the engineering done, it could also help release or get access to federal dollars down the road as well.
It's kind of like a phase one, right?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
My questions have been answered.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this is appropriate this time or maybe later on in the testimony, but I know that a lot of rail cars are actually owned by various businesses and so forth. My question is, do we know the owners of these? Are they the rail line themselves or are they individual? And then what is the disposition later if they're not used for any period of time? I certainly wouldn't want this to become a railroad junkyard. So I'm just curious if there's any thought.
Representative Koznick, or I see we have somebody here from NDOT, and I also see Mr. Appice on the call for the railroads, but Representative Koznick.
Well, right now, Progressive Rail has a lease rights to the segment of track that is usable. Some of it is quite unusable. So basically, think of it like a parking lot that they have lease access rights, and the cars that are stored there are some are owned by the railroads. Many are owned by individual companies, and they have no place to put them when the market's down. And so that's what started the problem. But the rail yard would, as Representative Murphy mentioned, will be in a contained, safer, more environmentally safe area, and then also be more efficient to provide freight movement and products across the state and many of the communities that I mentioned previously.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Yeah, that's kind of what I was kind of getting to. If they're owned by another company, I'm wondering if, and this could be answered later on in other testimony, but wondering if then privately owned cars, if they are charged a fee for this storage area. I know that almost every place that we go, if you're storing somebody else's property, there is fees for that. And I'm just wondering if that's going to be collected and where that fits into this too during the planning session. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can answer that later.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Any other questions? Any other questions? I see no hands jumping up. If not, Representative Kosnick renews his motion that House file, I'm sure I get the number right.
3456.
3456 be laid over for possible inclusion. That members will lay the bill over. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you.
The next bill we have on our agenda is the Federal Funds Local Assistance Program, and Representative Cagle's name is attached to that. Is she back? She's back. Representative Cagle, if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this, I guess, the coded, the language that we have that was submitted is our attempt at working through the IIJA, the Investment, Infrastructure, and Jobs Act from the federal government. And so what we are looking to do is we're certainly looking at the discretionary funds of this program and trying to figure out how we will have that match available to eligible applicants for the federal funding, and how we can also assist some of the smaller entities to apply for some of the discretionary fundings through the IIJA. So would you like me to walk through kind of the language, Mr. Chair?
Representative or Vice Chair Cagle, yes, that would be nice.
Okay. I just need to get to it because it's not a bill number, so I apologize. I just came back from Texas. So the Federal Local Assistance Program, what, you know, first section just kind of is the definitions, establishing the program, and asking the Department of Transportation to establish the program. What the local aid match is the funds that will be made available for the program. And this is strictly the match for the discretionary competitive grant programs. They have to be transportation related. And then the section five or subdivision five is the aid recipient eligibility. And so we're actually still trying to work through some of this language to make sure that we have encompassed all of the agencies or entities that are that qualify for the federal funding. And we also put some program evaluation in there so that the so that MnDOT would be able to kind of prioritize or select projects that align with our legislative priorities and goals. And then the allocation categories, again, is just asking, you know, how allocating the funds to specific programs related to local roads and bridges, transit projects, and then there is a large chunk of that funds that is flexible because there are so many unknowns with the federal IIJA. We need to allow some flexibility in there as well. And then just some reporting requirements. And then section two of the bill is our federal grants technical assistance. And this is kind of one of those things where I used my work on other committees, kind of like the DEED programs, where they offer technical assistance to organizations that are looking for funding. And so I kind of imagine this as like an RFP that MnDOT would put out, and then they would evaluate the projects and determine who they could help to get that, you know, help with the grant writing and technical assistance of federal grants, because they're complicated. And so we want to make sure that we are giving the state of Minnesota the best possible chance to take advantage of the federal money that we could, that could be awarded to our state. So I guess that's just kind of a quick overview. This is still a work in progress. And so I would welcome any feedback or discussion on the proposed language.
And we have two testifiers listed. Ms. Christine Elwood from MnDOT, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Christine Elwood. I'm from MnDOT. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for State Aid and Statewide Radio Communications. At State Aid, we are really dedicated to the success of Minnesota's local transportation system. We provide tools to those local agencies to help with their transportation system needs. So I want to thank Representative Cagle this year and for the discussion back and forth and the comments. And we've talked this morning a little bit, and we support this bill and the use of these funds for the local agencies. We do have some concerns about how State Aid would administer this program with the local agencies as currently written. And so we have three suggestions. The first one is engagement of our stakeholders. So State Aid is willing to engage the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Tribes, Minnesota Association of Townships, Minnesota Association of Small Cities to develop some modifications to the bill that are supported by these organizations. The second is grant writing, and we recommend that the funds for grant writing technical assistance would be provided directly to the local agency to help them hire a consultant to write their grants. We believe this would be more fair and allow the local agencies some autonomy, and yet this approach could be administered through State Aid, and we also could offer grant writing workshops. The third thing is local match consistency. So to be fair, we recommend a consistent local match of 20% be provided for the amount of the grant awarded. So in closing, State Aid can provide more information on technical comments and assistance with changes to the bill and the program as needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elwood. And I'll take questions after the next testifier. Mr. Appitz, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for letting me speak in support of this legislation that provides funding and technical assistance to IIJA grant recipients. There's more detail of our interest in this in a letter that's attached to the materials that you've got. But in speaking with Representative Cagle yesterday, she expressed a willingness to expand this initiative to possibly include short line railroads. You're thinking short line railroads, cities, et cetera. Let me explain just real quickly, and perhaps others who are competing for federal funds. There is a lot of money in the IIJA, and it makes eminently good sense to do whatever we can to secure a reasonable amount of that for Minnesota and Minnesota communities and Minnesota transportation projects. The IIJA has significant amounts of funds for transit and for passenger rail operations, but comparatively little for freight railroads. The single program in IIJA that deals with freight railroad operations is called the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure and Safety Improvements Program. It's called CRISI. And CRISI got a boost to about $1 billion a year for the next 5 years. The only problem with it is it's on a competitive basis, and we're competing with about 600 other small railroads across the country. So providing matching funds and technical assistance through MnDOT can improve the chances of Minnesota Short Lines being able to secure some of this money. Mr. Chair, just real quickly, the latest state rail plan indicated that there were about $250 million worth of improvements needed to shortline railroads to bring them up to current operating standards. So if you look at this technical assistance, the matching assistance, and Representative Torkelson's bill, which would add some additional funds for the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, between this bill and that, we could improve the chances of getting additional resources to fix up our short lines and a lot of other transportation programs in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Apitz. Questions? I see Representative Petersburg, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question could either be done by Vice Chair Cagle or by the department, Ms. Elwood. But from what I had heard before, we were looking at somewhere in the need of over $160 million in matching funds for the IIJA. And so my curiosity is this $38 million or approximately that's in this bill? What would that cover? What doesn't it cover? And do we need to look at the whole gamut of projects rather than a specific piece? If you could kind of clarify that.
Representative Cagle, do you want Ms. Elwood to handle that?
I can take it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. So what this bill does is this strictly looks at the discretionary funding. So there's multiple programs. There's lots of programs, tons of programs within the IIJA. Some of them are formula funding, and so they require formula matches. Well, some are completely discretionary funds. And so what this language deals with is strictly just that discretionary pot of money. For the formula piece, we can kind of calculate, you know, exactly how much money we will be getting and how much money will it will take for the formula. The discretionary funds are completely, you know, we have to submit the grants and make sure that we have the local matches. And so there's no guarantee that that money will be awarded to us. But by having the local match and the technical assistance, it actually increases our chances of getting that discretionary funding into the state.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Cagle. Can you give us some examples of what you perceive would be some of the discretionary funds that we might be looking forwards for these matching funds?
Representative Cagle.
Yeah, so, oh boy, let me cruise through my email here real quick and find them. I know that I have a spreadsheet somewhere that has all the discretionary programs on there. If you want to just give me a second.
And maybe Ms. Elwood could help. Or
I got it. So there are programs through the IIJA that, so like airport infrastructure grants, bridge investment programs, congestion relief programs, planning grants, and I'm just looking at the dot. Training and education, technology and innovation deployment program, rural surface transportation grant program, railroad crossing elimination program. I have a whole spreadsheet that I can share with you if that would be helpful.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I think that might be helpful. I appreciate that, and I'll leave my comments for later if I need to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Peterson. Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question and one quick suggestion, which maybe is unnecessary, but you don't reference specifically the federal infrastructure bill. You just say federal funds. Is there a reason for that?
Representative Cagle.
No. Mr. Chair and Representative West, no. I think I was just working with House staff to that was the suggested language from House Research.
Representative West.
Oh, I was just wondering. I'm not trying to get you or anything. Yeah. And on the section where the tribes are referenced, it just references tribes recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. A small suggestion would be just make sure, like, a Minnesota tribe, because technically unless I'm missing something that could be broader than that.
Representative Cagle, that something to look at, a suggestion that I don't know if that is needed or not, but.
Will do. Thank
you. Sounds like a good suggestion. Any further questions? Representative Peasberg, do you want to make some closing?
I guess I would just say, is this going to be laid over, or when it comes to us officially, or what is the plan of the chair for this bill?
I'm not sure. Maybe Representative Hornstein, Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Representative Peasberg. I appreciate that question. Before I head off to my next committee, I'm glad I'm here. We wanted to have an initial hearing today to get everyone's comments and suggestions. And I would just suggest that members of the committee, as well as people that have a real stake and interest in this bill, contact Representative Cagle. The comments today were really helpful and important. We're going to look at this, assemble any amendments. I would like to run them by you, Lead Peasberg, ahead of time. And then I think we could address those in the markup session. I'm not sure we'll have an opportunity to revisit this week. You know, if we do, it's certainly useful to have some more committee time, but that's limited. But it would be certainly my intention to take some amendments and, vet those as we mark up the bill.
Representative Peasberg.
Yeah, thank you. And just to follow up to Mr. Chair, so this could be actually a vehicle for further expansion of IIJA additional matching funds, or do you see that limited just to this discretionary funds?
Representative Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peasberg. I'll defer to Vice Chair Cagle on that, but there are, as Vice Chair Cagle mentioned, there's grant programs, discretionary programs. There's this kind of a basket of three or four. We'll be taking a look at later in the week at the Met Council piece of this, which deals with electric buses. We feel that within this area, we're looking at approximately, $80 million over not only this biennium, but into the future. Which is consistent with the governor's recommendations. But I'll have Vice Chair Cagle take a stab at that one as well.
Vice Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peasberg. I think the intent is just to keep it, with transportation and with the discretionary funds. That's how I've been working it. And that's my kind of plan going forward.
Representative Peasberg.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Cagle, if you want to wrap up, and then we'll lay this over and Representative Cagle.
Look like Chair Hornstein had a comment.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to let you know I have to head over to another committee now to present a bill. So thank you so much. I'm glad I was able to be on for this session.
Timing was great. Your timing was great this morning or this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Like I said, this is still a work in progress, and so there's so many unknowns with this federal program right now with the IIJA, and so I really want to make sure that we allow flexibility, but also, give our state the best chance to invest in our infrastructure, and, we're kind of at this historic moment, I guess, I think, we need to make sure that we get as much money from the federal government into Minnesota to improve our infrastructure across the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cagle. Next, members, we have the governor's revised supplemental budget for transportation. And just let me read here what it says. It's going to be presented here. We'll start with our presentations. We have the Department of Public Safety. We have Colonel Langer here. We have Mr. Hansen from the Office of Traffic Safety. So why don't we start here with the Colonel Langer? I guess that's from the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Hall, is that the intent here?
Yes, Department of Public Safety may have staff available if Colonel Langer is no longer available, but we start with the Department of Public Safety.
Sounds good. So the Department of Public Safety, is Colonel Langer available, or is somebody else going to do the presentation?
Mr. Chair, if I can, this is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and I believe that Colonel Langer needed to leave before this time. So we do have a number of individuals, including Jordan Haltoft-Hyde, who is the Director of Legislative Affairs for the department. And we will talk quickly through the revised supplemental budget recommendations and requests and be available to answer any questions.
So as new people talk, if they can identify themselves, and Commissioner, you can proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. So first, again, Cassandra O'Hearn, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and I want to thank the committee for hearing the supplemental budget requests. Jordan, do you want to get to the first slide? As we move forward, there are a number of issues. The first is the deficiency request, and that is for the State Patrol to cover the unexpected large-scale events that occur at the state capitol, as well as for ongoing capital security costs. As you're aware, there have been a lot of activity to ensure the safety of those that are visiting, protesting, exercising their First Amendment rights at the capitol, as well as general capital security costs, and that is a over $3.5 million request out of the general fund. The other is the VEST reimbursement program, which this is the funding that goes through the Department of Public Safety that provides the funding to local law enforcement and to officers for their soft body armor, otherwise known as bulletproof vests, right? And that protective equipment. We continue to run out of money long before the end of the fiscal year. And so what happens is these requests from the agencies as they hire new officers, for the officers themselves that are entitled to get reimbursed for soft body armor, I think it's once every 5 years, those applications cannot be reimbursed until the next fiscal year. By that point, there's a big backlog from the prior fiscal year that we weren't able to fill, and we're not able to catch up to be able to do that. And so that is what this request is for. With that, Jordan, you want to take over to talk about the State Patrol instead of Colonel Langer, who is sorry that he was unable to be here.
Yes. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn and members of the committee. My name is Jordan Haltoft-Hyde. I am the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. For the Minnesota State Patrol, in the governor's revised budget, there is funding for a replacement helicopter. This helicopter, and there's ongoing funding as well for maintenance and training, would be safer, it'd be quieter, it'd be newer, it would require less maintenance, it would also allow the State Patrol to get rid of one of the older helicopters that is taking up more of the time and has less flight time, or is available to fly less now. The second portion of the State Patrol's request is for a federal match for commercial vehicle enforcement. This would allow for increased enforcement activities, including the monitoring of weight stations, lane enforcement, and school bus inspections, and also the education that the State Patrol likes to do in the commercial vehicle area. These are trunk highway funds, not general funds, as that's how this is always funded. And this would open up the ability to really access those federal funds within the patrol. I'm available for questions to answer any questions on the State Patrol. And next, I'll hand it over to Director Mike Hansen of the Office of Traffic Safety.
Thank you, Jordan. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Hansen, and I have the privilege of serving as the director for the Office of Traffic Safety at the Department of Public Safety. Our portion of the supplemental budget request has to do with the formation of an advisory council for traffic safety. And what I know all of you have the one pager that we prepared that explains the rationale and some of the steps that would take place to form the advisory council. But its basic purpose is, as all of the committee members know, the last 2 years have been just horrific on Minnesota roads. And the time for bold action really is now. If we're going to reverse the terrible trends and the completely preventable deaths and serious injuries that are taking place on our roads, the advisory council will bring together all of the important stakeholders that touch every bit of our transportation system that can and do affect traffic safety on a daily basis. It will really allow us, you know, traffic safety, it's a local issue as much as anything. And where we really need to focus our efforts is on the local traffic grants, the public outreach, the media, and the education efforts, supporting our local safe roads coalitions. You know, we all know Minnesota has 87 counties. Currently, the Office of Traffic Safety, using federal funding, we're able to support at a minor level, about 22 Safe Roads coalitions across the state. That's not enough to turn the needle the way that we need to turn it. And we need to expand the resources that those Safe Roads coalitions have available. And that the purpose of the fiscal request is to support those efforts and to support that through media, to support that through various equipment that we can put out there to demonstrate how safety equipment can and should be used, all kinds of educational material, as well as some staffing that would really help to support and bolster those public outreach and education efforts. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has. And again, we appreciate the time and the consideration today.
Questions, members? Questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was trying to catch up writing all that stuff. What is the full request for DPS in the supplemental budget between the two biennials? Does anybody have that figured out?
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Yes. Paul,
I will say your last name, Justin Jordan, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg, I will get those numbers to you today after this meeting. I'll follow up with you on that.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to the helicopter. What is the current number of helicopters the department's operating, and then how old is the oldest one?
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, I will get you these details. I believe currently the department has 3 helicopters, and I will get you the year on the oldest one and if that is the one that would be replaced.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this proposed helicopter offers some new features that are currently unavailable on the equipment that the department has. Can you just give us a rundown of what will be added as far as features on this new machine?
Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, for the question. Yes, the main feature is this would be a twin-engine helicopter, which the State Patrol currently does not have. It would certainly make it safer for the pilots and also better suited for rescue missions all around the state. If there's any other features that this would be able to provide, I can certainly get those to the committee in talking with the patrol.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you for that. Any idea what kind of demand we have for rescue operations?
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I will need to follow up with you on that question. I can get that information to John Howe as well for the committee.
Thank you. I'd appreciate Torkelson. That. Thank you. I'd appreciate that very much. That's all I have, Mr. C-Team Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any other questions, members? Go slow here because I know sometimes people struggle to get their hands put up. Any other questions? Doesn't appear to be any. Commissioner, if you want to wrap up, do a wrap up on everything, and we can move on.
Thank you. I just want to take this opportunity to, again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank the committee members for hearing this today. We will circle back with answers to the questions that were posed. And as always, we look forward to continuing to work with you as we proceed through the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, and then Mr. Howell, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the last of our agenda. And Mr. Howell.
We've got MnDOT and the Met Council.
Oh, MnDOT and the Met Council. I'm sorry.
As well. That's okay.
That's
we have Interim Commissioner Dallenberger, I believe, from MnDOT is here, and they have a brief presentation.
That's why before I did anything that I shouldn't have, I asked the committee assistant. They keep us as chairs on track. MnDOT, Assistant Commissioner Dobenberger, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you can proceed with your slideshow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Nancy Dobenberger, Interim Commissioner for MnDOT. We appreciate this time you've allowed us today on your agenda to provide a brief update on the revisions to the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations for Transportation and an update on information related to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, as we've been calling it, the IIJA. And these are updates from the last time we shared information on these topics with this committee back in mid-February. And I also have with me today from MnDOT, our Director of Government Affairs, Eric Rudin, our Chief Financial Officer, Josh Kanaderud-Hubinger, and our Budget Director, Sam Brown. And I will go through the slides all on my own, but I will likely be calling on my colleagues to help with any questions you might have afterward. So, Sam, I believe you are running the slides. If you'd go ahead and advance it. Thank you. Right. So one of the revisions to the multimodal transportation package is for assistance to small cities. So I'd like to note that small cities do not receive any funding from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. So this is an important recognition by the governor that there is an unmet transportation funding need for cities under 5,000 population for construction and maintenance. There are over 100 cities in Minnesota who'd be eligible for this. Go ahead and advance the slide, Sam, excuse me. Yeah, and thus the request is part of, or the revised request is part of this multimodal transportation package is now $50 million per year from the general fund, which now includes this additional $10 million per year for small cities assistance. And that's along with the need discussed previously for the match money for the IIJA funds. Go ahead and advance, Sam, thank you. All right. And the other revision includes a request for operational costs for the second train from Twin Cities to Chicago. Both Minnesota and Wisconsin will split the operational costs. And we've looked at it two different ways based on passenger miles and boardings. And based on all that, it will be about a 50-50 split between the two states. We received a revised restoration and enhancement grant went from 3 years to over 6 years. And in the first year, the state share of the grant or the federal money, the match, the federal money, is 10%. And so that would be $740,000 from Minnesota. And then for the next year, where it'll be fully operational, so more operational costs, the match is 20%. And then that comes to $3.69 million for Minnesota. And that progresses up to 100% as the state's share. So both states, Minnesota and Wisconsin, would have 100% responsibility as of 2026. And with that, when you take off the amount that would be covered by fares, that'd be about $8 million. So Minnesota's share out in 2026 would be about $4 million. Go ahead and advance the slide, Sam. Great. So this slide just shows the timeline that notes some milestones with IIJA. So this is kind of the IIJA update that I'll touch on. As we've mentioned before, November 15th was when the IIJA was signed into law. And then when the beginning of the calendar year started and the legislature started up, we had, before that, the governor's budget proposals that were released. And then the session began at the end of January, where we were requesting the budget authority to spend the additional federal funds that come through IIJA, along with those match needs that we have for those additional funds. And so since the act was signed into law, we've had opportunities to engage with our stakeholders, and including a couple work groups that have been established and just met for the first time last Friday. We have our program update work group, and that's a group, kind of an ad hoc group, that we get together when a new federal bill comes along and we talk about the program structure. We updated the membership based on some new programs and a fresh look at the program update work group list. And we also established another work group based on some new programs, and called the Climate and Resilience Work Group. And so those work groups just met last week, and we have other engagement opportunities coming up with stakeholders over the coming months as well. But the other milestone noted there is March 12th. That's when the appropriations bill was signed into law. So that was very important to get the money that basically filled those buckets that were established as part of the IIJA. So now we have that appropriation from the federal government. And why don't you go ahead and advance the slide? I'll say more about that appropriation bill. Right. So as we've discussed before, IIJA transforms the federal-state transportation partnership and includes new aspects of the definition of transportation, including carbon reduction, climate resiliency, restorative justice, broadband and electric vehicle infrastructure, and includes those into the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Framework. And this is a five-year reauthorization law, which will help for planning with longer-term projects. And the amounts on this slide note funding that came through, additional funding that came through with this Appropriation Act at the national level. And so with that, the IIJA provisions were funded, plus an additional $3.5 billion in additional federal funding for Transportation and Housing Subcommittee. Some earmarks came through with that, to the tune of $1.45 billion, of which $847 million is for through federal highways, and additional federal funding for highways, $1.1 billion extra for formula-based bridge program, and the additional funding for the grant programs provided an additional $775 million to the fiscal year 22 RAISE grant program. So a new total for that program is now $2.25 billion. And then note too, $250 million for competitive resilience grants came under the PROTECT program. So next slide, Sam. And just to kind of summarize this, this slide shows the state and local agencies' match need for IIJA, and this is based on the historical federal funding split of 70% state, 30% local. And as I mentioned, MnDOT convened the first meeting of our program update work group and our climate resiliency work group last Friday to begin those discussions about that program structure and whether or not this split of funding should be adjusted. So those discussions are taking place now, but assuming the program split largely stays about the same, these are the amounts that would be needed for the programs using a 20% match for federal funds through Federal Highway Administration, which comes to $40 million for the state and $20 million for local agencies, assuming a 10% match for the Federal Aviation Administration funding, so $7 million, and 36% for the Federal Transit Administration, another $7 million. And that would just be for MnDOT as part of the Transit Administration funding. So you might recall we needed to make an assumption about discretionary program funds that could come our way. And with that, approximately a 20% match, we would need about $112 million for those discretionary programs matching. We're excited to go after those funds too. So with that, I thank you for your time today, and I will stand for any questions.
Questions? I see Representative Petersburg, you have your hand up.
Get myself unmuted here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One is in regards to Amtrak, and let me just see if anybody can clarify. I know that we heard in previous testimony that in previous bill that the Amtrak up to Duluth, Amtrak was covering 100% of the cost for the first 6 years, and then state representative would cost after that. In this case, it's only for 3 years. Why is that difference? And then I have a question about the discretionary funds, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, or do you have somebody, or Commissioner, do you have somebody else that could answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand the question, and Representative, as I understand the question, it has to do with why the for what we're requesting here would go over 3 years, or now it's been revised to 6 years, and that is the enhancement grant that we received. So it's staggered in terms of what the percentage that the state would owe, but that's the type of grant that we received for this particular project. Did that answer your question? If not, I might need to turn to someone else.
Mr. Petersburg, I think I see Mr. Radin has put his camera on. Does he have an answer?
Well, let me just clarify, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Okay, Representative Petersburg.
So we had talked about extending or still having a Amtrak run from the metro area to Duluth, and Amtrak was going to cover 6 years of that cost before the state be responsible. The second line to Chicago, they're only covering 3 years, and my question is why the difference?
And Mr. Radin, if you want to identify yourself, maybe you can answer. Sorry for cutting you off, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair. Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And I think Commissioner Daubenberger indicated, it really just depends on which federal program you're funded through. And so the grant that we received for the second train to Chicago had a certain set of requirements. The train to Duluth would be funded under a new set of requirements that have since been enacted by Congress as part of IIJA. So I think, it's just really probably a matter of timing as to when the service would be funded and started as to how long the operating grants would be available for.
Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And my follow-up question is, again, to Acting Commissioner Daubenberger. In regards to a previous bill that we heard about discretionary funds, we were appropriating between $40 and $80 million, but your projection is for $112 million. Do you have any comment about if there's additional need than what we've talked about in the previous bill?
Commissioner Daubenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. You know, at this point, maybe I will call on our CFO for MnDOT, Josh Kanateru-Hubinger, to talk about how that was calculated, what that was based off of.
Mr. Kanateru-Hubinger, again, identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your answer.
Happy to. Glad to be here for the record. I am Josh Kanateru-Hubinger, interim CFO for MnDOT. To that question, we're working with lots of assumptions and estimates at this point. So that $40 to $80 million that's included in the governor's proposal as available for discretionary grants would go a long way towards delivering what we think we might get. But to be very clear, that one slide that illustrated we might get in the magnitude of $450 million of federal funds a year, that's just working off of assuming we as a state get 2% of all the programs out there, knowing full well that in some areas we're going to do very well, and in some other programs, we might not get anything. And so that $112 million that was on the screen is just the math based on that $450. The matching requirements vary wildly as well. So anything is better than nothing at this point. And as we progress through the next couple of years and we know more about those specific programs, I think we'd have a better sense of what that true need is for specific projects. To date, since that bill was signed into law, we have had, I want to say, four or so notice of funding opportunities come out for programs like RAISE and INFRA and that large mega projects. And then also one for rural projects. And the matching requirements are very different for each of those programs. How much is on the table is a little different than we thought maybe at the beginning of those estimates. So long-winded way of saying there's a lot we don't know. We're working towards better numbers as we go, but lots of estimates and assumptions at this point.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Acting Commissioner Dobenberger. These discretionary funds, and it seems like there are quite a few categories. I'd just like to know a little more about how you determine which ones you're going to apply for, or do you just apply for everything and hope some spaghetti sticks to the wall? What is the approach there?
Commissioner Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, appreciate that question. So we have a lot of projects that we are developing, and when we get the notice of funding opportunities for these programs, we dig in pretty quickly to understand what the criteria are for the various programs, from everything from when they need to be delivered to how much is available, and comparing that with what money we have on a project at this point, where we have that our program, but also the different aspects of the program that are being described in these notice of funding opportunities and how they relate best to the projects we have. So we dig in pretty quickly to take a look at what we have, what lines up with the different programs, what would be the best candidates. And these are our projects that have already gone through our selection process, but if they are in the STIP. But sometimes we even need to look out further if there's an availability of funding out further and put forth the best candidates for each of them. And yes, we do try to go after as many as we possibly can with good candidates.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. At what point is the public able to see what projects you're applying for and what the progress is and how much money is involved, that sort of thing?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think I'll defer to Mr. Rudin. He probably recalls best at what point we make public the decision that we're putting forth an application.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do try to be public about those funding opportunities we're going after. In a lot of cases, local governments are also applying for these grants. And so once we kind of know who's applied for what, we try to assemble a list and share that information publicly. And then certainly in the case where we've been awarded a federal grant, typically US DOT does a press release at that time to kind of announce the successful grant recipients around the country, and that's usually something that we would reiterate here at the state level as well. So it's not an incredibly formalized process, I wouldn't say, but it is information that we try to share not only with our local partners, but also our federal partners. Our federal congressional delegation usually wants to know which grants we're applying for so that they could try to help us lobby USDOT on those applications as well.
Representative Torkelson? You done?
I'm done.
Thank you. Representative Halsman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To your slide with the local match, and a total of $185 million local match, as I recall from a previous presentation, that is per year, $185 million per year for something like 5 years. Is that correct?
Commissioner, I think they're trying to get up, find the right slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think I will defer to Josh Knatter-Hubinger on this again with the calculation on that.
Mr. Hubinger.
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, yes, these are all per year. Yes. So again, there's a lot of discretionary money out there, but I will just caveat that again. That's backing into that number, knowing full well we'll do very well in some and not so well in others. But yes, per year.
And did I remember correctly, was it for 5 years?
Yes. So the
Mr. Hubinger, yeah.
Apologies, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, yes. The bill goes from federal fiscal year 22 through fiscal year 26.
Thank you. I have
one
additional question, if I could, to the commissioner. I was so curious when you were coming with a supplemental ask whether there might be some ask for studies for passenger rail corridors. There are four that the Office of Passenger Rail in MnDOT knows about, and they have the total of what it would take. And we can't apply for federal funds until we have done those studies. Other Midwestern states, our economic competitors, are all moving on multiple fronts, and we seem not to to understand yet the economic impact that system of passenger rail could have. Other states absolutely understand that. But it doesn't appear as though we're making even a small ask in that area.
Commissioner, and I have a question, or if that was more of a comment from Representative Hausman.
Well, if she could point out to me where I missed it and that they are, in fact, moving forward.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. On that question, and in terms of seeking funding for studies, perhaps Mr. Rudin would be able to talk about more history on that.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman. Yes, you know, we do have a bonding request for trying to advance the NLX project. You know, I would say also that we are looking at updating our state rail plan, which I think is also an important step towards identifying those other corridors that potentially could be developed for our passenger rail network in Minnesota. So, you know, you're absolutely right that there is going to be some federal funding available to work on passenger rail, and we will need state or local matching funds to access those federal funds. So, you know, I think we certainly look forward to having that ongoing conversation with you and other legislators as we work on those projects.
Mr. Chair.
And members, one second, Representative Hausman. We've got one more presentation, so if we can move along. But Representative Hausman, we've got, we can go a little bit past 2:30, but we've got one more presentation from that council. Representative Hausman.
One more clarifying comment, if I could. MnDOT just sent me this week the description of those four corridors and the cost. So they were able to share all of that with me.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Representative Cagle, if you got a quick question, otherwise we can move on to the Met Council. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was kind of curious, back to that discretionary funding slide. You said that's all what your estimates are for discretionary fund. There's no formula match pieces in that at all?
Commissioner, or maybe Mr. Rabin.
Mr. Chair, the slide has both formula and discretionary programs identified. So the discretionary line is the line that was highlighted in red on that slide.
The rest, remember, that was $112 million. That was the approximate match that we had, $450 total.
Correct.
Representative Cagle. Thank you. The next we have a presentation from the Met Council, Mr. Thompson. Again, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Nick Thompson, Deputy General Manager, Capital Programs at Metro Transit. Are you seeing my screen? Looks like
no, it's not up yet.
Okay, let's try it again.
There we go. All right. That was coming.
So I'll be quick here, just going through the transit investment components of the federal infrastructure bill. This is authorized $108 billion nationwide for public transportation. This is the largest federal investment in public transportation in the nation's history. The like in the MnDOT had mentioned, there's both discretionary and formula funding within this program. A couple categories of competitive grant programs. There's the low no emissions grant program. That is currently one that is out for application. We will be applying in our region by May 31st for electric bus. There's also bus and bus facility grant program, significant funding there over what has been in the past. And again, it's a program that our region, we will be competing for. We are ready for a competition in these because we have a zero emission bus plan, which is one of the key requirements. The legislature last year had required that Metro Transit develop a zero emission bus plan. We do now have that in place that allows us to be eligible to apply for these grant programs. We've been successful in the past in seeking these. We've had $4.2 million for the low no emissions program in 2021. And we also received funding in 2019. And so these are programs that we've been well, that our region has done well. It's not just Metro Transit, but our suburban transit providers also seek competitive grants under these programs. MBTA has been successful on two grants. And then our new Minneapolis bus garage, which at the time was called Hayward 2, also was successful in receiving federal funds. And we anticipate that we'll be applying for more. And the increase in the size of those programs will make us a better, improve our chances of receiving federal funding here in the competitive program. These all, like all these competitive and discretionary, they do require match requirements. The low no emissions is 15% match, and the bus and bus facilities is 20%. Sometimes these programs score, you have a better chance of success if you match above that amount. So that's some of the criteria that we look at. But they're used for purchase of buses, improvement of existing buses, or expansion of bus facilities. The other major improvement here is a 30% increase in increase in the formula funding for our region, which is called 5307. That is for Metro Transit, the contracted services at Met Council, and the suburban transit providers. This is an area that we've been told there's going to be a 30% increase over what we've, and on an annual basis over what was prior to 2022. We're still waiting for some guidance on what the level of that total dollar value will be. But again, this is another funding source that needs match. And so as the formula funds increase in our region, so does the match for that. And then lastly, the Capital Investment Grants Program. This is the program that funds our major transitways. We'll be seeking capital investment grant for Gold Line project this year. Purple Line is an example. There was a significant increase in capital investment grants, which makes receiving grant opportunities in that program more likely for our region. That's an area that is matched by our county partners. So we should have a local match identified for that. It just increases our chance of success and the timing of receiving those capital investment grants. And that's just the brief overview that we have for you today.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Members, any questions? Seeing no hands jump up, members, and Mr. Howe, if you just correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the last of our agenda. And with that, members, our next meeting is March 31st. And the committee plans to recess at 2:30 and then come back after session, floor session on Thursday. So members, be aware with your schedules. And with that, members, we're adjourned.